Iraq's health ministry says more than 50 people are killed in a fire at a hospital ward treating COVID patients in the country's south. Palestinians demonstrate outside an Israeli prison near the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah, calling for the release of a detained lawmaker to attend her daughter's funeral. Also ahead, France says it will not allow health staff to go to work and will not pay them if they are not vaccinated against COVID-19 by mid-September. Good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, dozens of people have been killed after a fire ripped through a hospital in the southern Iraqi city of Nasiriyah. The fire engulfed a COVID-19 isolation ward in Al Hussein Hospital. A medical source said the rescue teams are struggling to reach those patients who are believed to be trapped inside the building. Health sources say the death toll could rise as search operations are ongoing for many missing patients. Initial police reports suggested that an oxygen tank explosion inside the ward was the likely cause of the fire. In April, a fire caused by an oxygen tank explosion at a COVID-19 hospital in the capital Baghdad killed more than 80 people and injured 110 others. Palestinians have staged a demonstration outside an Israeli prison near the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah, calling for an immediate release of a detainee to attend her daughter's funeral. The protesters chanted slogans in solidarity with Khalida Jarrar, a Palestinian lawmaker serving a prison sentence at the Offa prison. Palestinian rights organization Al-Haq has sent an urgent appeal to the United Nations calling for her release. Palestinian activists and rights groups have also put up an online petition, but the regime has so far denied the request. Jarrar was given a 2-year sentence on alleged charges of inciting violence and belonging to a banned organization. Her 31-year-old daughter was found dead at her home on a Sunday from an apparent heart attack. Iran says its position on Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal has not changed since the beginning of the negotiations, adding that certain issues are still unresolved. The foreign ministry spokesman said a long way has been taken to tackle the issues, but the remaining path is not smooth. Saeed Khatibzadeh noted that Tehran's demands during the talks have been very clear. The United States must first remove all sanctions in a verifiable manner. He stressed that Tehran regards any extra demands beyond the original deal as irrelevant. Meanwhile, Washington said it is ready for a new round of talks. The U.S. does not participate directly in the negotiations, which have been held 6 times since April. A former British Parliament speaker has become the latest European politician to support an armed terrorist organization bent on overthrowing the Iranian government. John Bercow, who joined the MKO's annual gathering in Albania virtually, has been criticized for associating with a terrorist cult behind assassinations and bombings that resulted in the deaths of thousands of Iranians over the past 4 decades. Saeed Porreza reports.
Yet another attempt by a banned terrorist organization at rebranding itself as a legitimate opposition group in exile. The Mujahideen Khalq organization, known as the MKO, which held its annual gathering in Albania, featuring generously paid politicians and former government officials from the US and Europe, giving carefully worded speeches in person or online. among them former British Parliament Speaker John Bercow, the man who recently defected the Conservative Party for Labour after launching a withering attack on his erstwhile party member, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. We reached out to Mr. Bercow's media representative requesting for clarification regarding his involvement with the MEK. Received an automated response saying they would be in touch shortly. We are yet to hear from them.
I think our politicians need to be careful about how they behave, and that's politicians of all colours. And I think, unfortunately, they're really stretching the bounds of ethics and what it is to be a public servant, which is very unfortunate.
Former politicians speaking at the MEK's annual gatherings is not without precedent. Over the years, the terror cult has splashed out sizable sums of money to enlist the support of people in power on both sides of the Atlantic. Most notably, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton paid upwards of $40,000 per speech in 2018.
Only three reasons can explain why the former Speaker of the British House of Commons might speak to the MKO. Either he literally doesn't know of the thousands and thousands of people this terrorist organization has killed, or he doesn't care about that, or the money was so tempting that it became more important than any moral objection to the MKO.
The MKO, who used to be based in a large military garrison in Iraq, fought against Iran alongside Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and provided material and intelligence support in a conflict that lasted 8 long years and left hundreds of thousands dead, injured, or displaced on either side. In 2000, they were designated as a terrorist organization. 12 years later, the U.S. government removed them from a list of terrorist organizations, and in 2013, the terrorist group relocated to a vast and tightly guarded barracks in Albania that few outsiders have ever entered.
Experts say to see former American and European officials support a known terrorist organization in return for money speaks to the double standard exercised by those individuals when it comes to the issue of terrorism. Saeed Puriza, London.
Turning to other news now, France has introduced mandatory COVID-19 jabs for healthcare staff while other restrictions remain in place to curb the resurgence of the virus in the country.
For care workers and non-medical workers in hospitals, clinics, care homes, homes for handicapped people, for all professionals or volunteers who work in close contact with the elderly or those who are fragile, including at their homes, vaccinations would be made mandatory without waiting.
Macron announced that those who opt against the vaccination will be barred from several public places and services, including cafes, restaurants, long-distance buses, and medical establishments. The French president also said that restrictions will be tightened further to fight a recent surge in cases. Meanwhile, other countries in Europe, including Spain and Greece, also introduced new restrictions amid a rise in infections. Greece has made vaccinations mandatory for certain workers and announced measures to contain the spread of the virus. In Spain, the Catalan and Valencia regions have also introduced new restrictions to curb the soaring infection rates. Chris de Honde says the lack of COVID vaccinations and the spread of the Delta variant are the two major problems France is currently facing with.
The French government faces two major problems. They said beginning of January that most of the French people should be vaccinated, so end of June, which is not the case because many people, the holidays started, and only 40% of the French population has received two jabs and are vaccinated, which is a low level compared to the UK, for instance, where they have 60%. And scientists consider that the population should be vaccinated like more than 70, even 80% before obtaining an immunity, a global immunity. So that's not the case. That's the first problem that the French government faces. The second problem is the arrival of the Delta variant, which is not causing a huge increase of death casualties at this moment, But the fear is there that because of the holiday season started, that the Delta variant could cause huge problems. Therefore, the Macron government took two major decisions. First of all, health workers, but also retirement home workers, they are obliged to be vaccinated starting in September. It means if they are not vaccinated, they cannot continue working. The second measure is that people who want to go out to public places, bars, restaurants, cinemas, they will not be obliged to vaccinate, but they will have to show or they are vaccinated or they receive a negative PCR test.
Meanwhile, Brazil's federal police have launched an investigation into President Jair Bolsonaro over his government's alleged irregularities in the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines. The probe was opened at the request of the country's Supreme Court. Federal prosecutors and the Controller's General Office are also separately investigating the vaccine deal. Allegations of irregularities are surrounding the $316 million deal signed with a Brazilian intermediary in February for 20 million doses of vaccines produced by India's Bharat Biotech. A Senate commission investigating the administration's handling of the pandemic has cited suspicions of overpricing and corruption related to the contract. The president has denied any wrongdoing. The government, however, suspended the contract after reports of irregularities became public. And the World Health Organization slams rich countries for considering COVID-19 booster vaccinations while the most vulnerable in other nations were left exposed to the virus.
The global gap in vaccine supply is hugely uneven and inequitable. Some countries and regions are actually ordering millions of booster doses before other countries have had supplies to vaccinate their health workers and most vulnerable.
The WHO chief also criticized vaccine manufacturers prioritizing deals for booster third doses rather than first and second shots for the completely unvaccinated healthcare workers and elderly people in poorer nations. Tedros said vaccine nationalism was, quote, prolonging the agony, and greed could be the only explanation of the ongoing vaccine crisis. The remarks come as the total number of people diagnosed with the virus worldwide inches closer to 187 million. COVID-19 has also claimed more than 4 million lives globally since its emergence in late 2019. Political commentator Romero Funes says the vaccine's distribution by rich countries is a classic example of capitalism where profit is prioritized at the expense of human lives.
There is definitely the issue of vaccine nationalism plaguing the imperialist, wealthy, capitalist countries that have the resources and the capacity to help vaccines spread them around the world in an orderly fashion and an equal fashion. However, we're seeing the classic symptom of capitalism where this system does not prioritize human lives and human beings, it prioritizes profits. And let's not forget that Big Pharma that runs the US government, Pfizer, Moderna, these huge companies don't have an interest in saving lives. They have an interest in only seeing profitable lives, lives that they see as a business and in favor of their revenue.
Turning to other news, the death toll from last month's building collapse in the U.S. state of Florida has risen to 94 as search teams recover more bodies from the pile of debris. The Miami-Dade County mayor said 83 of the bodies have been identified, adding that 22 people still remain unaccounted for. The 12-story building in the town of Surfside partially collapsed on June 24th. No survivors have been pulled alive since the first few hours after the collapse. The rest of the still-standing portion of the building was leveled due to safety concerns. Multiple investigations are underway to ascertain the cause of the incident. A 2018 report had warned about the building's major structural weaknesses. Chinese Navy forces drive away a U.S. warship after it entered the country's waters, calling on Washington to stop, quote, its provocative actions. The incident comes amid simmering tensions between the two sides in the region.
There seems to be no end at sight to tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, China's military announced it drove away a U.S. warship that it said illegally entered Chinese waters near the disputed Paracel Island. It also urged Washington to stop such provocative actions. In reaction, the U.S. Navy claimed that the USS Benfold asserted navigational rights and freedoms in the vicinity of the Paracel Islands. It also dismissed China's claim of a serious violation of its sovereignty as false and a misrepresentation. The U.S. move coincided with the fifth anniversary of an international arbitral ruling that favored the Philippines and invalidated China's maritime claims in the South China Sea. Beijing has consistently dismissed the tribunal's finding. Regarding the occasion, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on Beijing to stop what he called aggressive acts in the South China Sea. Blinken said that freedom of the seas was an enduring interest of all nations.
Nowhere is the rules-based maritime order under greater threat than in the South China Sea. The People's Republic of China continues to coerce and intimidate Southeast Asian coastal states, threatening freedom of navigation in this critical global thruway.
The South China Sea has become a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington over the past years. The U.S. routinely sends warships and warplanes to the region to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation, ratcheting up tensions among the countries in the region. China has constantly warned the U.S. over its military activities in the contested waters. Beijing and Washington are also at odds over a range of issues, including China's policies with regard to Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as their trade policies and origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Amid strained relations between the two sides, there have been fears that the South China Sea could emerge as a potential flashpoint. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under U.S. President Joe Biden, who succeeded Donald Trump in January. But a new administration has shown no sign of backing down on Trump's hardline policies toward China.
Thank you for staying tuned to World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the limelight.
From London's Grenfell fire to Miami's Champlain Tower South, politicians need to be held to account for gutting regulations that could mitigate disasters, says Natasha Leonard Ryder in an article titled "Miami Building Collapse Shows Tragic Costs of Neoliberal Deregulation." Stay tuned for more. Ago in London, a fire sparked by a malfunctioning appliance tore through the entirety of a 24-story residential tower block, leaving 72 people dead and over 200 people without a home. While situated in one of the city's richest neighborhoods, the high-rise building was part of a public housing complex, home to low-income, working-class Londoners. Tower Block's name, Grenfell, is now Cindy Dock for a tragedy born of government austerity, property sector avarice, and disregard for human life. Residents who had complained that the building was unsafe had been ignored or even threatened with lawsuits. The government body that oversaw the complex was found to have chosen cheaper, more flammable insulation materials for its walls, which accelerated the blaze. The country's conservative government had championed deregulation and neoliberalization, enacting vicious cuts to social services. Grenfell was the result. And about 150 people remain unaccounted for following the collapse of Champlain Tower South condominium complex near Miami, with 11 found dead so far. We could not help but think of Grenfell. The analogy is not perfect. For instance, the condo residents are wealthy property owners. Grenfell residents were some of the poorest in London, relying on the state to house them safe. And the time elapsed since the horrors of Grenfell have given us insight into the multifaceted failures, whereas we do not yet know the precise cause of the Miami building collapse. Yet, the tragedies share a crucial commonality. Irrespective of the particular causes, with more robust regulation, prioritizing human life over property and profit, these deadly events could have been mitigated, perhaps even avoided. Grenfell and Champlain Tower South are what can happen when the vagaries of the market determine how we live. When housing is first and foremost seen as property and asset and not as dwelling for human beings. The latter view opens the door to the sort of regulations that could have potentially averted these disasters. Basic efforts like regular timely inspections and high-grade building materials by catching them in early even stages. Such change is infuriatingly unlikely because there is so little accountability for the authorities responsible for imposing such regulatory regimes and dealing with the fallout of subpar housing. Grenfell changed everything. That this catastrophe of austerity and corporate governance served to reshape the British government's treatment of housing to serve people over profit. It did not. Boris Johnson is prime minister and his Tory government has overseen a death-dealing pandemic with the same discriminatory disregard as his colleagues and predecessors in Parliament oversaw Grenfell. Sajid Javid, Secretary of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government at the time of Grenfell fire, has now been awarded the role of Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, which includes overseeing Britain's COVID-19 response. Following the fire, Javid consistently failed on promises to swiftly rehouse surviving residents and would not commit government funding to something so crucial as sprinkler systems in Tower Blocks. One of the grimmest lessons of Grenfell, then, is that even the most terrible of mass death events do not ensure necessary political change. The powerful are all too happy to weather the tragedies of their own making from which, on the whole, they do not suffer. Despite the differences between Champlain and Grenfell, that tighter regulations could have mitigated the tragedies, as is evident in the early Miami news, as it was when the cheap, highly flammable insulation made headlines in London. In 2018, a report by an engineer on the Miami condo found evidence of major structural damage to the concrete slab below the pool deck, an abundant cracking and crumbling of the columns, beams, and walls of the parking garage. A major repair project was beginning on the building, but only 3 years after the fact, tragically too late. Residents had complained of cracks and water leakage in their apartments, too. Blame has understandably been laid at the feet of the condo board, which was responsible for building repairs. Unlike Grenfell, the Miami building was not under the government's remit, but rules governing safety checks and audits are very much the purview of politicians and public officials. Florida law only requires that buildings and properties be structurally inspected every 40 years, which is the process the fallen condo was undergoing before the collapse, wrote Fabiola Santiago in the Miami Herald. That is far too long to go without an audit of conditions that affect hundreds of people, as this horrific collapse has demonstrated. Santiago also cited Democratic Florida State Senator Annette Tato, who tweeted that buildings need to be inspected much sooner than 40 years, especially in a country where sea level rise can affect a foundation. If the lesson from the condo collapse is that regulations must shift toward more frequent checks, that would be something. The horror of events will no doubt prompt other condo boards to act with swift concern for their own buildings. Residents in public and low-income housing, however, may not have the resources to ensure their blocks, built on imperial terrain, are protected. The Champlain Tower South collapse has highlighted how a neoliberal approach to regulation can make victims of the wealthy too. There can be little doubt, however, that is the poor who will suffer most if this disaster does not prompt politicians to act to ensure safer housing for all. There certainly needs to be government support for buildings whose owners themselves cannot cover timely checks and audits. And even this will be insufficient in a part of the country threatened by climate devastation, where property developers nonetheless build and sell waterfront properties as if the world were ending, and it is. Instead, if a structural reckoning with the livability of the land and protection of all residents, pumps are installed and roads and buildings are raised in piecemeal efforts. Shortly after the Grenfell fire, as the building's charred remains still stood, author Yusuf Al-Genghi wrote that Grenfell has become a grim moment, a ghastly tomb symbolizing the Tory austerity regime. Arguably, it is bigger than that, a proxy for the unmitigated folly of the neoliberal ideology of deregulated free market orthodoxy favored by successive governments. Nowhere is that ideology as entrenched as in the U.S., and the Miami building collapse in many too. Become a symbol of its unmitigated folly. This will not, however, be sufficient to establish a politics for people over profit. Yet, it is a reminder that we must.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the host of this program. This is Viewpoints. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, and we want to discuss another important topic regarding the speeches and the addresses of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Brother Ali Alevian, and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, and Brother Ali Alevian, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaykum assalam, thank you for having me here.
So today we want to talk about the important concept of adala, or justice, in the thoughts and speeches of Ayatollah Khamenei. I think, Brother Ali Alevian, the greatest injustice towards oneself is not considering your own talents and potentials that have been put by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in you. Because Allah, we have it also in the Holy Quran, that puts some of his ruh, isn't it? A spirit in you. Yeah. So if we got this divine nature inside ourselves, and we are not observing, well, we can say, and we are not keeping track of our own talents or potentials, or we are wasting our time. See how much time we are wasting nowadays in 21st century. So these are all the examples of injustice that one can do towards himself without calling them injustice. And at the same time, the great contradiction is here, that we are looking for justice from outside.
Very true.
Okay, from the people who are outside.
Very true. Look, I think whatever is whatever is a sin can be looked as an injustice.
Okay.
So when you are neglecting and ignoring your own your potentialities, and then you got given, got gifted talents. That's so right. it is again a sin. So because you are actually losing a capital that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala actually gave you as amana, as trusteeship, that He has left it with you, but you do not look at it and you ignore it. So it is exactly on the same actual explanations. But it does not mean that all human beings need to be, and he explained actually, do not need to be infallibles. But to the extent that they refrain from committing an sin, they are actually observing adala or justice among themselves.
Right.
And when we have not yet practiced adala or justice among ourselves, on ourselves, then we cannot prescribe it for others, as I said earlier. So the one that you mentioned, the talents that we have, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave us, we need to appreciate them and use them in the best way possible.
Look at how much time we are wasting during the day, in the 24 hours. I think this is doing injustice to ourselves, isn't it?
Yeah, even among the sins, the famous sins is that itlaf al-waqt, I don't know what is it called, wasting of the time.
Waste of time,
is among the sins that one can commit. So what can be the reason? Because every single minute of us should have its meaning. When we are sleeping, if we are sleeping for the same final goal and objective, which is Kamal, so it is Ibadah, is looked at as Ibadah, as okay. Worship. If we eat, so our eating or, I don't know, mealtime is not a wasting of the time. It's again for the same, it's a tool for the same purpose. When we even talk to friends in order to actually to create ta'lif al-qulub, that is closeness of the heart. So it is also looked at as ibadah. So every action that we have in our lives, when we give it a taste, a flavor of ibadah, so it is with that intention, it is an act of ibadah. So it is in the same, let's say, way.
So putting now we are putting everything in its proper place.
Yeah,
that's right. So and this is one definition of the justice that was
that
given.
We looked
okay.
at it as
well. Okay, thank you very much. And you know, but these people, these persons in the society are living in a society, Said Mohsen. And you know, if a person has observed justice inside himself, at last he will get into the society with mm-hmm. all the people. So the social justice and Adalat Ijtimai now comes to the scene.
Yeah.
What does it mean? I think this part of you know, Adala has been very much emphasized by the leader, also the late Imam Khomeini. And this type of social justice is what really the world nowadays is looking for.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we have different movements, different right movements all across the world looking for social justice, okay? So what is social justice? First, let's give us a definition, Said Mohsen.
Well, before entering to that, I just marked a statement from Dr. Shariati.
Very good.
You know, when you were talking about the justice individual, that we don't think about ourselves, we generally yes. think from outside bringing a justice.
Yes.
There is a statement by Dr. Ali Shariati in which he said, when I was you know, studying, I used to think that I will change the world. One day I will change the whole world.
Uh-huh.
And then when I finished my studies, I thought that I cannot change the whole world, but I can change my country.
Mm-hmm.
And later, after some time, I came to the conclusion that I cannot change the whole country, but I can change my city.
That's right.
And similarly, he comes down, and after some time, he says, I thought, like, it's hard to change the whole country or city. It's better to start from the family
uh-huh.
Because they're living with me. And then he said, at the end, I realized that I cannot even change the family. I can only make some changes in myself. And then he concludes that if the very first day I would have think of changing myself, because of change in me, my family would have changed. And because of my family, my, you know, neighborhood and the city would have changed. So it's a reverse, we can say, you know, process.
That's right.
That even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala also refers, in the Quran refers to this point. And even for the teacher, you know, we use the word mu'allim
mm-hmm.
for a teacher. Mu'allim is not a person who gives ta'aleem or who teaches something. Mu'allim is basically a person who learns things and who starts living according to those things that he have learned. And in his actions, he is basically observing all those things that he have learned. And once he's living like this, the people around him, his students, when they see him, you know, living like that, they change themselves because of his actions, not because of what he is teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Because many times we have seen that there are many people who say something, but they don't practically do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the general comment is when he is not himself, you know, practicing this, why we should do this? This is a general comment that comes. So basically, mu'allim or a teacher is a person who has trained himself.
Preachers without practice. That's right.
Teachers without practice.
Preachers.
Preachers, yes.
That's right.
We had a discussion the other day about the Catholic preachers.
Yes.
You know, the most problem that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Christianity is talking against the LGTB
yes.
movements. But in Catholic Church,
yeah.
we see the same thing. The scandals.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
the preachers without practice.
Wow.
So when you yourself is not changing yourself,
mm-hmm.
this is something natural.
Mm-hmm.
The being up in a pair,
yes,
you know, relation, this
yes.
kind of relation, it's a natural thing which
yeah.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has brought. So anything which goes against the nature, against the fitrah, it's against the religion. It's against the justice.
That's right.
It's being unjust.
And from here and there comes the news, you know, the scandals of the bishops and the, we can't say, that's right, the fathers
yeah.
all around the world of this child sexual abuse and pedophiles and come on, man.
It's
What's
all because
happening?
Of injustice, you know?
Yeah.
This has related to individual justice.
And see how much scandal and disgrace it comes for the religion, you know?
Yeah.
it brings for the religion, causes for the religion. This is really sad news. And that's why, in terms of the social justice, when we are talking, sometimes the people do not trust the religious class of the society, Brother Ali Al-Abiyan. Yeah. They look for the social justice from the lawyers,
yeah,
or from the congressmen and women, or the people who are the members of the parliament or something like that, and not the religion. In terms of the politics, they can achieve social justice more than the religion. And this is really, really a sad news.
This social justice is, I think, the most important type of justice, mm-hmm, that is seen more by others.
Yes.
And it's also
more touched, in fact.
And more touched. And that's, it's right, also, let's say...
what do you mean by others?
By people.
By people.
By people.
Yeah.
Actually, this is the link between other types of justice and the other types of justice we discuss, and the that's next right types that we might be discussing. Like, it has been based on the first two types that we have already discussed, that is religious adala and also personal, because it is based on these two.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it is also, the outcome of it will show itself in the economic and also political adala as well.
That's
so
right.
This is the mean among all these, let's say, different types of adala.
That's right.
And what is it? It is to help those who are in need and those who are under oppression. This is what actually intellectually can be derived from the meaning of it. And removing the gaps between different classes of the society. So this is what we expect and all the people expect from social justice. And this is what all the prophets wanted to see, the fruit of adala in this kind and in this type of adala, in this type of justice. And when we see that in the words of the leader of the Islamic Ummah, and also the late Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, they were always actually targeting this kind of adala, and they were talking about this social justice rather than the other types. Why? Because when personal justice is there, when the religious justice has been already digested by people and by the communities and societies, then the outcome and the fruit of it, which is social justice, is there.
That's right.
And in case there is a deficiency, we have to see what the problem is with the basis, that is personal, and then we see what the problems that we see with the, let's say, outcomes of this social justice should be quite clear and natural with what we face in the field of social and political justice. So this type of justice is very important and need to be looked at very seriously, and the basis should be first observed, and then inshallah the outcomes,
that's right,
of this justice will come naturally and automatically.
And if the people in a Muslim land are not feeling the sense, the true sense of the justice in a society, for sure they will be attracted by the other schools of thoughts in other parts of the world. And this is, unfortunately, we can't say what's happening. But the case is that, as you said, the justice seekers exist all across the world.
Yeah.
And in different societies, and sometimes we see that the people who are non-religious, non-Muslims, are attracted to some of the concepts inside the religious context, one of which is justice and social justice. And in terms of the Mahdawiya and the last Shia Imam, Imam al-Mahdi,
mm-hmm,
you know, this adala in the ijtema, or in the community and society, is the commonality that exists between we as Shia Muslims and the other brothers from the other, we can say, religious denominations like Christianity and Judaism. And we find the same language, the same tongue among each other. I mean, this type of social justice. Inshallah, one day, the Imam will reappear, and the true social justice will be observed and will be implemented in all parts of the world, inshallah, one day.
Inshallah.
Okay, the political justice and economic justice remains untackled. And
actually, as I said, these two are the fruits and the outcome,
yes,
of the social justice,
yes,
to see that people are benefited from their rights politically and economically.
Okay.
So this is, again, another, let's say, interpretation of social justice. And
that's right.
I think they are already covered in the social justice.
Okay. So one important topic remains untackled, and that is what are the obstacles in the way how to implement justice in the society. There are for sure some obstacles. We'll discuss them, inshallah, in the upcoming session of the program. Thank you very much, Brother Ali Al-Abiyan.
Thanks to you,
and Said Mohsen Naghvi for a nice elaboration on what the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, has said regarding the topic of justice. Dear listeners, thank you very much, too, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/ Ian Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
About you, IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Texas Republicans move legislation to overhaul the state's voting system closer to passage on Sunday, 11th of July, brushing aside fierce opposition from Democrats to gain approval from key committees in the House and the Senate after marathon weekend hearings. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist David Montgomery. The piece is titled, After Marathon Hearings, Texas Republicans Advance Voting Measure. Texas Republicans move legislation to overhaul the state's voting system closer to passage on Sunday, 11th of July, brushing aside fierce opposition from Democrats to gain approval from key committees in the House and the Senate after marathon weekend hearings. The committee votes, coming just days into a 30-day special session, adhere to Governor Greg Abbott's timetable for swift action on the legislation, which he has called a priority for his administration. The full 31-member state Senate is expected to vote on its bill as early as Tuesday, 13th of July. The 150-member House is also likely to take up its own version of the measure this week. Democrats on both committees united in opposition to the bills and prepared for further combat on the floors of the Senate and the House. Beverly Powell, a state senator from the Fort Worth suburb who voted against the bill in committee, said Senate Democrats were planning many amendments during the floor debate and might even try to introduce an alternative bill. The Senate State Affairs Committee took about 45 minutes on Sunday afternoon to approve the bill, known as SB1, on a 6-3 party line vote after slightly modifying the bill with 9 Republican amendments. "We feel good about the bill," said Brian Hughes, the Republican committee chairman. Earlier, the committee was in session for nearly 15 hours until about 1:30 a.m. on Sunday, 11th of July, hearing testimony from more than 200 witnesses, many of them opposed to the bill. The hearings before the House committee went even longer, concluding at about 7:30 a.m. on Sunday, 11th of July, with a vote to approve the bill after nearly 24 hours of debate and public comment. All 9 Republicans on the committee supported the bill, while the 5 Democrats voted against it. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, has said that passing a new voting law is one of his top priorities. He called the legislature into the special session, which started on Thursday, after Democrats blocked the bill in late May with an 11th-hour walkout from the Capitol that denied Republicans a quorum. Hundreds of Texans flocked to the Capitol over the weekend for the committee hearings on the campaign voting bills being pushed by Republicans, part of a national effort by the party to impose new restrictions on state election systems. Republicans say the restructuring is necessary to improve voter integrity, but Democrat-aligned opposition forces are fighting what they call an unprecedented campaign to suppress voting rights. "This is the single greatest coordinated attack on democracy in our lifetime, and perhaps in the life of this country," said Beto O'Rourke, a former U.S. representative and candidate for president, who has taken a lead role for Democrats on the voting issue and was at the Capitol for the hearing. But Mr. Hughes, the Republican chairman, opened the hearing on Saturday by declaring that the legislation was designed to create a better election process that's safe and accessible. House and Senate Democrats have vowed to do everything necessary to kill the legislation a second time, but their options are limited. They have hinted that they are prepared to resort to another bold move, such as staging another walkout or possibly taking the more extreme step of fleeing the state. Studies consistently rate Texas near the top of the list of states that make it harder to register and vote, which explains in part why the Democrats view the stakes as so high. The voting bills would ban 24-hour voting and drive-through voting sites, increase the criminal penalties for election workers who run afoul of regulations, limit what assistance could be provided to voters, and expand the authority and autonomy of partisan poll watchers, among other provisions. But 2 provisions from the earlier session that Democrats had vehemently opposed were removed: a limitation on Sunday voting, and a proposal that would have made it easier to overturn an election. for the hearings over the weekend, Democrats and voter advocacy groups opposed to the bills had rallied witnesses from around the state to testify. State Senator Boris Miles, a Houston Democrat, said two busloads of witnesses and a 20-car caravan had made the trip from his district. Both Boris Miles and Linda Hidalgo, the chief executive of Harris County in Texas, the state's most populous county, told reporters that the bills would extract a harsh toll in the Houston region by dismantling election innovations, such as 24-hour voting, that were put in place during the 2020 presidential election. "We're under attack," Boris Miles said. After getting a late start on the voting measure by spending hours on a bill, on a bail overhaul bill, the House committee worked through the night to hear many of the nearly 300 witnesses who had signed up to testify. Several who were still waiting in the committee room past dawn began to joke about the time and expressed gratitude to Trent Ashby, the Republican House chairman, for not shutting off the testimony. "Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for staying," said Hector Mendez, representing the group Texas College Democrats. "Happy 6:30 a.m. to all of you," another witness said. Although Democrats sought more time to digest the bill, Mr. Ashby said he wanted to proceed with a committee vote because of the compressed nature of the special session. Before voting to send the measure to the full House, the committee also rejected 8 amendments offered by Democrats, also along party line votes. Texas follows several other battleground states controlled by Republicans that have passed substantial overhauls of their election laws and enacted new voting restrictions this year. Since January, at least 22 bills that make voting more difficult have been signed into law in 14 states.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.